Hi, everyone. I'm Raj Kumar, President and Editor-in-Chief of DevEx. This week, we'll be breaking down the big headlines in global development and bringing in some top experts to help us do it. If you want to follow along with the stories we're talking about, check out devx.com and subscribe to our daily newsletter, The Newswire. There's a link in the description. Follow us along on Twitter, and you can see many of the stories we're talking about today. And we'd love to hear what you think. This is This Week in Global Development.
I am joined by two colleagues this week, Sarah Gerving, who is a senior reporter here. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Raj. How are you?
Yeah, great to have you here. And Anna Goel, who is, of course, our managing editor. Hey, Anna.
Hi, Raj. Great to be here.
Yeah, we're joining from all over the world today. I know, Sarah, you're based in Nairobi. I'm actually in Los Angeles today for the Milken Summit and about to join the Aurora Humanitarian Summit. And Anna, I think you're back at HQ in Washington, D.C.
I am. Good old Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Well, lots going on, as always. A lot more headlines than we'll even have time to get into. But I can tell you here at the Milken Global Conference, which is really a conference that primarily draws people from the world of finance and business, but increasingly has become sort of a West Coast Davos. And you've got lots of world leaders. You know, Elon Musk was here and Bill Clinton was here. You've got lots of people increasingly from the development and humanitarian community. We had the heads of Sesame Workshop, Sherry Weston. We had Sheila Davis, who runs Partners in Health, Yanti Sirupto, who runs Save the Children US. So lots of international development humanitarian leaders and many, many more than that. You can see a bigger list if you take a look at our newswire, where we mentioned some of what happened here this week. But interestingly enough, almost every conversation, and there have been lots about refugees, lots about climate, they almost all at some point bring up election. And it's just hard not to. This is the year when 60% of the world's population live in countries that will have elections, and some of them are seen as really consequential in terms of aid policy itself, and then many related things like climate policy and refugee policy. And we had a big piece this week that gets into that, all about European parliamentary elections. Did you have a chance to look at that, Sarah?
I did, yes. So our colleague Rob Merrick wrote that the EU development policy could be at a turning point due to the European parliamentary elections, and those will be held in June. But it's taking place against a backdrop of sentiments that are anti-foreign aid and anti-immigrant, as far-right parties are on the rise. So he wrote that the suspicion is that kind of these fringe ideas are moving towards center stage. But one expert he spoke with said that these shifts have already happened in the past decade in the EU aid policy, and there has been this kind of growing shift away from eradicating poverty as a priority, and a shift towards spending more aid on economic development, or excuse me, investments. So he's keeping a close eye on that election.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting when it comes to donor policy and how elections figure in, because sometimes as you get close to an election, there is a desire to suggest it's going to be a binary result. And there's good reason for that, because sometimes the policy positions become a clear point of contrast between candidates or between parties. But I think as this piece shows, and is often the case, it's a little bit more nuanced than that, because there are forces even within political parties that have different views. There are reasons to maintain the status quo. And so I think even the same might happen here in the United States. We've seen it before, right? During the Trump administration, the first Trump administration, we don't know if there'll be a second, but in that first one, he had a lot of anti-aid policies, but a lot of it didn't come through because there were enough members of the Senate, both Democrats and Republicans, who preferred to continue something much closer to the consistent development policy the U.S. has had. So the piece sort of makes a similar argument that, look, there's a chance that this could really change and reframe the narrative and really change policy, particularly in terms of taking money away from traditional development assistance and moving it more toward migration efforts and efforts to stem migration, which is obviously a big driving force behind the right-wing movements in Europe. But it's not clear that that will happen. And it also references that, as you say, Sarah, there's been this shift from kind of a donor-recipient approach that Europe had long held to this more partnership approach through the Global Gateway. We've done, Vince Chadwick, our colleagues, and a lot of reporting on the Global Gateway, which is this investment strategy that's sort of meant to counter the Belt and Road from China. And there's a lot of questions of how successful that's been, et cetera. But the idea is, look, already a lot of these ideas that might be promoted by more right-wing populist parties are embedded in development policy in the EU. I don't know if you have a thought about this election, Anna, or anything else that you wanted to raise on the point of politics.
Well, being from DC, of course, I could hijack the podcast in terms of politics. But what I thought was also interesting on Rob's piece, and you talked about nuance, Raj, is that even if the traditional parties, including the center-right European People's Party, wins, which it seems to be forecast to have a strong, decent showing, it's already tacking to further to the right because of the rise of far-right parties such as Germany's AfD. And so the policies, even if these far-right populist parties don't, you know, ultimately win that many seats, you already have somewhat of a victory because the right is moving naturally, especially on migration issues. So, you know, in a way, that will be a de facto victory, I think. And that's probably more the likely scenario. Versus here in the U.S., you see that's an enormous trend. You see the Republican Party has tacked to the right in terms of MAGA politics and Donald Trump. And now you have, it's a much smaller wing, the traditional hawkish conservative wing of the Republican Party. And this has a lot, this will have a lot of bearing on U.S. foreign assistance. I agree, you know, we didn't see these dramatic changes in the first term, but we have a much more, you know, on the Trump team, it's a lot more organized in terms of who would potentially come into a second administration. So I think, and everything I'm hearing, and I'm sure you're hearing it as well, is there's real concern that this time around, U.S. assistance is in real trouble.
Yeah, and it is possible that the U.S. result, just given the nature of the system, could be more binary. You know, a lot obviously depends on what happens in the House and what happens in the Senate. We had in that first Trump term this kind of bulwark in the Senate that protected a lot of traditional development priorities. You know, will that continue if the Democrats lose the Senate? And even within that, if the nature of the Senate does turn more MAGA or more right-wing, and you have a Republican White House, and you know, maybe even if you still have a Democrat, if you get the Democrats to lead in the House, which is possible, it's still unclear, right? You may end up with a more binary result, more challenges for development policy. That seems to be the sentiment in DC these days. I'm also reminded when I read this piece by Rob Merrick about during that first Trump term, there was a lot of need, even while keeping development policy largely intact, there was a lot of need to placate some of the interests of the right. So for example, you know, there were some efforts to direct some PEPFAR funding, some funding on HIV AIDS to religious groups. And you can see that reflected in this piece by Rob, where he interviews a member of the Nationalist United Poland Party. And she says, you know, quote, "I'm a great believer in humanitarian aid," but then goes on to say, you know, "we should be linking more aid to the protection of Christians." And she says, quote, "what impressed me a lot when Trump ruled was that he put a great emphasis on aid that was directed to minorities, especially Christians in the Far East. I would like to see projects, these kinds of projects carried out by Europe as well." So you can see some of these, you know, even if you end up with, by some measure, less change in development policy, there are still important distinctions and priorities and interests that could get in. And obviously migration is a big reason pushing a lot of these political shifts in these elections, but not just in the most developed economies in the world. We had another piece this week about the situation facing the healthcare system in South Africa. And I thought that was a fascinating window because, again, in Europe, these right-wing parties are largely winning on the back of a migration message. But here you see similar political wins in South Africa when it comes to providing healthcare to refugees and migrants. That's a piece by our colleague Andrew Green. Sarah, I don't know if you had a chance to look at that as well.
Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting story about kind of politics coming in the way of access to health, which kind of manifests itself in a lot of different circumstances globally. But it's a piece that focuses on kind of the very complicated efforts taken by NGOs to deliver health services to refugees and migrants in South Africa. And so while the country's constitution does guarantee that everyone in the country can access healthcare services, whether they're a citizen or a foreign national. There are also some other laws that complicate the kind of atmosphere around this, so it doesn't always play out like this in practice. And the government has used foreign nationals as a scapegoat for why the health system isn't working for everyone. And so NGOs have tried to fill in the gaps, but that can create resentment within host communities and xenophobia. So Andrew wrote that kind of targeting in this way can also feel very arbitrary because many South Africans move around the country and can face prejudice when they're trying to access services in the new communities that they move to. So in his reporting, he focused on one clinic, and that was run by Medicine Sans Frontières, and it's since closed. But it was controversial as local residents considered it as a place for only foreign nationals and came to know that the services there were a bit better than the local clinics. So resentment grew from that. So one of the lessons highlighted in Andrew's story was that this experience was one of the lessons learned from that is to just not isolate people from the host community and try to create a more inclusive response to all sorts of people that are on the move.
That's right. And, you know, I moderated a session here at the Milken Conference all about refugees. And, you know, one of the big themes that came out, I guess it's since 2018 when the Global Compact on Refugees was put forward. And then we had just 6 months ago, late 2023, the big convening in Geneva. I forget the official name, but it was the big global conference on refugees. And one of the key themes that came out from the compact, from that big meeting, it came out in the panel that I moderated and has been big in the refugee community now is, look, we have to care about host communities too, because you have 75% of refugees in the world are in low and middle income countries. And if you don't think about providing services to host communities and making sure it's a welcoming environment, you're going to end up with exactly this kind of problem. And the piece has some dramatic, you know, little anecdotes in it about people being dragged out of hospitals, about a pregnant woman giving birth at a train station because she was rejected from a couple of hospitals. So that's the kind of thing that can happen if you don't have a holistic plan around ensuring the host communities feel like they're getting some of the benefits too from hosting refugees and from all the international aid that and even national government aid that has to come to support those refugees.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen this kind of in refugee camps that I've visited is there's problems when a huge influx of individuals come in and the host community feels like they're not accessing that. And then also kind of struggling for resources in that setting as well with the huge influx of people.
Yeah, I think the other big theme that came out of the session that Milken put together is that, you know, if you really think about the refugee problem as a problem for government, you're never going to get to this point where you can truly support host communities and you're going to really change the dynamic, that the only way to do it is to really create a different environment where individual families see themselves as potentially sponsors for refugees, to welcome them, host them, put them up, where businesses see opportunities for refugees and they think, like, this is an opportunity in our community, maybe we can create jobs for them. You have to really change that dynamic. And so we had on the panel a lot of conversation about places this has really worked, including here in the US, where there's been some real success around this approach. And this holistic approach is, I think, part and parcel with ensuring that host communities feel like refugees aren't a problem, but are actually an opportunity for them and for their families. And it's a different frame, and certainly not the frame you're hearing from the right-wing political parties in Europe, but maybe it's the frame that helps to preserve the consensus around development assistance and around support for health and education and these kinds of important services for refugee communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And just kind of that integration. And there's many different approaches to how governments take on refugee situations, and there's governments that really work to integrate communities, and others that really keep them segregated and dependent on aid, and it has real consequences for interactions with host communities.
Or Anna, did you want to jump in?
Oh no, I was just going to agree that in a way it's all about PR and how you communicate this story. Unfortunately, there's a lot of politicians who this is kind of a radioactive subject, which is a shame because, as you said, when you go about it in a smart way of having families host refugees, of emphasizing the economic benefits of migration, of immigration in general, I think, you know, it can change the narrative. But unfortunately, it's one of those dicey propositions that a lot of politicians just aren't willing to go there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Or they see it as an opportunity to divide and to win votes, you know, and so it's seen as like, well, let me take advantage of this situation. And obviously, again, as the panel I was a part of really emphasized, this is just the beginning of a much larger wave of migration. I mean, we now have an increase of about 50% of the number of people in the world who are forcibly displaced from their homes. So around 120 million people now, up in just the last 5 years by about 50%. And that trend line, if you look at what's happening with climate and with conflict, and if you talk to the experts, it appears that that's going to keep going. Exactly at what rate is unclear, but that it's going in that direction, up and to the right. And you're going to see, you know, just a bigger and bigger strain on the existing humanitarian system and on host communities. And so you do need a different approach. You do need, and I think that's why Andrew's piece is so important, because it starts to underline that if refugees are going to come to a place like South Africa, they're probably not going to come for 6 months or a year. You know, the other big trend, in addition to the numbers growing, is that refugees are sticking around. It's just not easy to go back, especially when people are moving due to climate and conflict. They can't go home safely. So you're ending up with people living their entire lives somewhere else. And so this is not just a question of like a temporary refugee camp with tents. This is a question of, can the health system absorb this many people? Can the education system absorb this many people? Because it kind of has to. So anyway, these are, I think, longer term questions that we, of course, at DevEx will continue to cover.
Hi, I'm Kate Warren, Executive Editor at DevEx. If you are listening to this podcast, you're likely working to achieve the Sustainable Development Goals. But are you subscribed to DevEx Newswire? Global development can be a fast-moving, complex sector. Our team of global reporters work every day to bring you the news you need to make sense of it all. In DevEx Newswire, we keep you up to date on issues ranging from climate change financing to gender equality and global health to transforming the food system, all in a fun-to-read, free newsletter delivered directly to you 5 days a week. Join the hundreds of thousands of global development professionals who receive DevEx Newswire and visit devx.com/newsletters to sign up to this free newsletter today.
I want to shift gears. I want to hear, Sarah, from you about an exclusive piece that you wrote this week, all about the Africa CDC. Maybe you can just tell us a little bit more about that story.
Yeah, so we published a story earlier this week, and that focused on a special audit report from the AU that looked into a series of whistleblower allegations that were made against Africa CDC's director general, Dr. Jean Kaseya. He had kind of over the past year, he took over the role a year ago. So after an email was sent, a whistleblower email was sent in February to over 60 donors and partner organizations and AU officials, Dr. Kaseya asked the AU Office of Internal Oversight to analyze the allegations. So the auditors found kind of a variety of things, and they found evidence to disprove some of the allegations against Kaseya, but had inadequate access to fully examine others. And the audit also raised concerns about weak financial controls, as well as irregular hiring and procurement practices. And one of the headline concerns out of the audit was the procurement of an event planner for Africa CDC's flagship conference that was held last November in Zambia. So the invitation for bids for the job had only been sent to four companies, and it should have been open to the public. People not qualified in procurement evaluated the company proposals, and they didn't follow the rules, and the contracted company breached the contract. The contracted company was initially awarded 600 around $620,000, but were ultimately paid nearly $2.4 million. The audit cautioned that these failures to follow the AU's procurement rules could create an avenue for fraud. Another issue highlighted in the audit was hiring irregularities. It said Dr. Kaseya hasn't always followed the rules when appointing new staff, and highlighted cases where merit and efforts to create regional balance and gender equity weren't prioritized. So one case, for example, someone who the auditors wrote basically failed the interview was appointed. And then the other major concern was oversight of the organization that Africa CDC works with to carry out its programs. So Africa CDC depends on partner organizations to manage donor money on its behalf, because the organization is still building up its internal systems in areas like financial management. But it has limited powers it has limited oversight powers over these organizations. So, for example, the AU isn't able to audit them. And then the auditors did also find reasonable explanations for some of the accusations against Kaseya. For example, he was accused of misusing donor funds in purchasing a vehicle while also having access to an AU car. But the auditors found that the AU car was only on loan, and one of the agency's donors agreed to buy him a car. So the auditors kind of overall, the auditors warned that these challenges that they raised in the audit carry reputational risks for the organization. And they made a series of recommendations for how the organization should change. Kaseya wrote a response to the auditors, and he acknowledged a lot of the agency's shortcomings and then kind of plans for changing the organization.
Well, congrats on the piece, Sarah, because it's really nuanced and in-depth, and that's exactly the kind of reporting that I think is needed here. And it does make clear, like, a lot of this may be not due to Kaseya himself. A lot of this seems to be due to just the nature of the Africa CDC. You know, I was interested to read about how only half of its staff budget is paid for by the AU. So they've got to raise funds from external donors. And there's a lot of rules around, you know, how they can use that funding to hire people, which sort of leads to the need to hire these kind of advisor positions instead of regular staff positions. A lot of the funding that they get from these external donors can't even go through the Africa CDC. They don't have the ability to take that money into their own accounts, and it has to sit with these third-party institutions like the African Society for Laboratory Medicine, and then they have to access those funds through those third parties. So it seems like some of this is due to just the growing pains of an institution that's still relatively young, is not fully funded directly by its host, the African Union, and has a number of systems in place that need to mature and to grow. On the other hand, obviously, there's an issue here with Dr. John Kaseya, in the sense that all these people have come forward with these complaints, you know, these whistleblower complaints. So something else is happening, too. But it's an interesting, nuanced story, right? It's not so simple just about one person.
Yeah, absolutely. And the AU is a complicated environment to operate in. And we have been reporting for several years about the evolution of Africa CDC. And it's a relatively new organization. It was launched in 2017. And it was initially a specialized technical unit of the AU. And that meant that its functions were managed within the broader AU, so within the AU Commission. And so financial management and human resources. But that was a problem because it was then kind of, it had to deal with the bureaucracy of the larger, broader AU. And that's not ideal for an organization that's mandate is helping the countries across the continent respond to health emergencies, because it's not quick enough, it's not nimble enough, it's not flexible. So the AU agreed to give Africa CDC more autonomy in 2022, but it's been this very lengthy process. So Africa CDC is evolving into this into a public health agency as opposed to a specialized technical unit of AU. But that's what's happening right now, is that it is building up these internal systems like financial management. And like, as you mentioned, partner organizations have been managing donor funds for Africa CDC. And just in March, Africa CDC hired their first director of finance. So we're very much in kind of this transition phase where it's growing, but it doesn't have enough funds. And there is kind of all of these oversight issues. But exactly as you said, there are, Kaseya noted in the in his response to auditors that a lot of the issues were pre-existing in the organization before he took over the role, and like things like procurement, they have let their partner organizations do procurement on their own without following the AU's rules in the past. But now kind of Africa CDC is working to build up its own capacity to procure. So yes, there's the audit said, you know, it was kind of a mixed findings in the sense that they did find evidence to disprove allegations, but also did raise the alarm that things need to pull together in a lot of ways.
Yeah, it's a really challenging issue, right? Because it seems clear that the global health community sees the need for a really strong and capable Africa CDC. On the other hand, they, as is often the case, external donors want to fund certain things, vertical things that they care about that meet their strategy in the way that they want to fund them. And Africa CDC needs a lot of core financing to just get its systems and staffing in place. So it's really challenging. And another, you know, part of the story where you talk about how they had this pre-existing issue even before Dr. Jean Kaseya took the role of maybe too many English speakers versus Francophone speakers, too many people from certain parts of Africa versus other parts of Africa. And for their legitimacy as an African Union agency, they need to have the kind of diverse background in terms of people. Yet you can imagine how challenging that is too, to shift the agency and ensure you're hiring from these other places when at the same time you want to hire the very best people. So this is not an easy task to build up Africa CDC. And I know it's kind of a controversial story because there's a lot of people who are really concerned with and focused on what's happening in that agency. A lot of people inside the agency clearly concerned, but it's so important. The outcome of this story is so important for global health in the region.
Yeah, absolutely. I found that quite interesting in the audit, that the point about kind of the imbalance. There were more than half of the staff. When Kaseya took over the agency, more than half the staff came from Kenya and Ethiopia. And that's very unbalanced for a continent with 54 countries. So yeah, I think there's a lot of, I mean, the audit had a lot of recommendations for how the organization should improve. And Kaseya himself had thoughts to put forward about how to improve the overall working environment. He said that the organization plans to establish an ethics office, and that would aim to improve workplace culture and provide an informal and confidential space to kind of identify and address issues. So it'll be interesting for us to keep an eye on that and see if that comes to fruition and how effective that is. But things like that are quite important. And yeah, there was a whole list of recommendations to help the organization move forward.
Well, it's a great piece and important read. I recommend people take a look at it. We're running out of time, but I thought we could at least flag one other story from this week, which is about the world wealth gap. You know, the UNDP reports annually through its Human Development Index, and we had a story by our colleague Alyssa Miolene about that wealth gap and where it's worst in the world. And it really just confirms something we've been reporting on for the last year or two, which is that, you know, many parts of the world were hit really hard. Many individual countries were hit really hard by the pandemic, but probably the worst in the world, and this report confirms it, was the Latin American region. And in fact, the Latin American region was hit really hard and has had the hardest time bouncing back. And we started this conversation today talking about politics, but you can just see, you know, in the region's politics, how much this has affected it. And you know, there's, I guess, in the region, the LATAM region in general, the piece says 12 countries were at least able to get back to their pre-pandemic levels in terms of human development. 21 have not. So it's really, you know, lagged the whole world in this sense. And it's leading to a lot of political polarization, as the story as the story mentions. I don't know if the two of you had a chance to look at that and had a thought about it.
Yeah, I think it was, striking that there was such, this really put into sharp relief the problems in Latin America, because we often think of the wealth gap in terms of other lower income countries, Africa, other regions of the world, and Latin America kind of tends to get shortchanged in terms of attention. And I think the other aspect that was also specific, well, not specific to Latin America, but that this index pointed out, is the falling trust in democracy. Even though Latin America is the third most democratic region worldwide, you're seeing that there's such little faith in the democratic process. And that's a very dangerous place to be at. It does allow for more extreme politics to enter, the mainstream. And it's a trend we're seeing worldwide. So it's certainly not, unique to Latin America, but it was some pretty depressing statistics. And the other takeaway I got is just how much the pandemic has these long-term repercussions. I believe the article said that this kind of halted a two-decade-long trend of progress, which came to a screeching halt in 2020. So, we kind of think of COVID as over, but for so many countries, you're still feeling these economic effects. And it's in so much of the developing world where you'll be feeling the effects, as experts say, for many years to come. And so I think that that's an interesting trend that a lot of people kind of say, oh yeah, and the pandemic. But really, it took such a huge toll on the developing world, and it's going to continue to, unfortunately, for I think years to come.
Yeah, and it's interesting. That's a great point. And to me, it's also interesting, and this was underlined in some of my conversations here at the Milken Conference, how if you look at the mainstream press in the U.S., almost all the humanitarian news is about Gaza and Ukraine. And those are, of course, two very tragic situations that deserve coverage. But, there are many others in the world. Sudan gets mentioned a lot because it's probably the most significant in terms of numbers of people affected. But right here in the Western Hemisphere, we've got a few major humanitarian crises underway. Venezuela is a really big one. And I had on the session that I moderated the former ambassador, the opposition ambassador from Venezuela to the United States. And he was, emphasizing that, look, there's 8 million Venezuelan refugees who had to leave the country due to the political dysfunction there. And we have an election coming up there. It's very unclear whether that will be a free and fair election. But there is an election coming up, and the outcome could lead to further humanitarian crisis and more people leaving. So that's a very big issue, which is right here, close to home. And many Venezuelans have settled in the U.S. and in other countries in the region. And then, of course, Haiti, which is in the midst of a very significant humanitarian crisis, political crisis. It's unclear how that's going to go. There's, soldiers, I guess, really police from where you're based, Sarah, in Kenya, that are headed over to Haiti to help, do something to alleviate the security situation. But it's by no means seen by anyone who's following it closely as a complete solution. And so that situation is dire. You've got other places like Ecuador, where there's a very serious, drug gang situation evolving. And then many other countries with economic challenges in the region, especially probably Argentina, with a new president that's really trying to push through some major shock therapy reforms to their economy. So this region, as the piece lays out, has not recovered from the pandemic. It faces severe inequality, really low trust in government, and on top of that, some really severe humanitarian crises.
Yes, absolutely. And I just to kind of add on what you said, I think it was that Alyssa's report, where it did focus on the implications of eroding democratic institution, it also noted that populist governments have lower growth rates. And I thought that was quite interesting as well to look at the economic implications of that populism.
Yeah, that's a great point. And Latin America has just been stuck. I did a series of stories for our pro audience in the last year or so. And I remember just listening to some of the experts talking about how the level of informality, right? So many workers are informal outside of the standard system, so they don't have the social safety nets. On the other hand, the social safety nets are expensive for governments that, find that they're not growing fast enough. Some governments in the region have a huge expenditure on civil service. So they're just kind of stuck in low growth, high inequality, And finding a model that lets them get out of that is really difficult. And obviously, there's a lot of variation among countries. Some have lots of natural resources, others don't. You know, some have different levels of dysfunction in government. But in general, the region has just been stuck with this this low growth and high inequality situation. Well, there's so many other stories we could get into, but I think we're running out of time. And so I want to just welcome our audience to, of course, subscribe to the DevEx Newswire if you don't already, where you can see everything you need to see from all the coverage we're doing around the world. And hopefully this podcast has just given you a flavor of some of the big stories from this week. It has been great to talk to you, Sarah Gerving and Agoel. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everybody. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
This has been This Week in Global Development. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe using the link in the description. To get even more coverage and analysis on the most pressing development issues of the day, become a DevEx Pro member by going to devx.com/membership and signing up. Thank you for listening, and see you next week.